Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. My name is Justin Gurdis. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm also a contributing writer for Green Tech Media. I'm going to start just by giving a little bit of context for why this panel is happening. So this is my eighth SCGA conference, and to my knowledge, I think this is the first time we've covered the offshore wind sector at one of these conferences. As a journalist, it's a really exciting time to be covering the industry. There's a lot of activity. Most of that activity up till now has happened in Europe, but we're finally starting to see momentum in the United States. Some of the big trends that are kind of marking what we're seeing is, first, much, much bigger turbines. So when I was in Denmark in October 2014, I visited a testing facility. And at that time, the world's biggest offshore turbine was 8 megawatts, had not yet been deployed. The manufacturer of that turbine, MHI Vestas, just announced recently that a 10-megawatt turbine is going to be commercially available. Earlier this year, GE announced they were building a 12-megawatt turbine that's going to go into the market in 2021. So bigger turbines. Bigger projects is another trend. So we're now seeing projects built in Northern Europe that are upwards of 600 megawatts, which helps drive down costs. And the third big trend is those falling costs. So, the mark against offshore wind in the past is that it's too expensive, but it really doesn't hold true any longer. So there's projects that are going to be built in Europe early 2020s timeframe. They're going to be the first projects, Germany and the Netherlands. They claim built without any kind of public subsidy. And even in the United States, there were some winning bids recently in Massachusetts that really shocked the industry, winning bids coming in at 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour, which people were really stunned that we were seeing those kind of numbers in the U.S. Before products even started getting built.
Can you put that figure in context? I've heard that figure a lot. Can you compare that to natural gas or other sort of things? 6.5.
Yeah, so the U.S. average retail electricity price is 12 cents, 13 cents a kilowatt hour. And the first offshore wind project in the United States, Rook Block Island, was like 24 cents a kilowatt hour. So really, again, stunning declines in a very short period. So that's kind of the context for where the sector is going. And, what's really exciting is that we're finally starting to see momentum in the United States. A handful of states, New Jersey, New York, Maryland, have finally started to have ambitious targets for deployment of offshore wind. Just this week, in fact, the governor of Virginia announced a new energy plan that had a target of 2,000 megawatts off the coast of Virginia by 2028. But the thing is, the U.S. still has a long way to go. I just mentioned there's, as of now, just one 30-megawatt project. I'm sure you've all heard of it, Block Island Wind Farm off the coast of Rhode Island. By comparison, they have 16,000 megawatts deployed in Europe. So the purpose of this panel is to figure out how do we catch up with Europe? How do we go from 30 megawatts to 16,000 megawatts? So I'm hoping our panelists here can kind of describe any kind of hurdles or barriers that need to be overcome, learnings from Europe that we can take reduce cost here, improve logistics. So with that, I'll turn to my panelists. I'm just going to have them briefly introduce themselves, and then I'll ask a few questions, and then I'll leave plenty of time at the end for all of your questions. So, Rob?
Hi. My name is Rob Sargent. I run the Energy Program for Environment America, which is federation of a bunch of state organizations in more than 20 states around the country, and I've been doing clean energy work for a long time. About 10 years ago, we sort of set our sights on looking at offshore wind, particularly on the Atlantic coast, for a number of reasons, but not the least of which as an environmental group, because there's an incredible amount of pollution-free energy out there. Cape Wind was starting to happen, and we started to look at what was going on there off of Cape, the proposal off of Cape Cod that some of you might have heard about. We saw a real void in any kind of sort of public outreach on this. Now, at the time, as Justin said, the cost of power was very high. The sense of the possible was very low. Despite there being some considerable progress in Europe, it was, I wouldn't say falling on deaf ears, but it was a tough sell and was hard to really get traction. And then it was compounded by the fact that Cape Wind might have had more, there might not be any facility, clean or dirty, that ever had more money spent fighting it. Probably maybe the KXL pipeline or something, but there was a lot of money spent trying to, and that created kind of a bad narrative, even though there was a lot of public support for that. Our basic strategy was to begin getting state policies in place. At the time that we started, it was the Bush administration, so we weren't trying to get federal policies. But very quickly then Obama came in, and we were working on sort of two parallel tracks to build support for policies that other people I'm sure will mention, specific and as mandatory targets as we could achieve. We got them in Maryland, New Jersey, a while back, and then more recently in Massachusetts, New York, and we upped it in New Jersey once Christie left. And so the basic theory was, and our basic strategy has been to elevate the sense of the possible. So people might see, we did a report recently, but it sort of mirrors a lot of what we do, is just to say, you might not realize there's this huge resource. In fact, off the Atlantic coast in particular, there's enough offshore wind potential to power the whole country and four times the electricity consumption of the Atlantic coast states. 12 of the 14 states have enough offshore wind potential to meet at least their current electricity needs. And our study went as far as to sort of envision what if we actually use that electricity to heat our homes and power our cars as well, just to kind of paint a picture of what was out there. The work that many people have done has created a lot of momentum. Our basic strategy is to sort of fan the flames of a race, mixed metaphor, race to the top. And it's been working. And, you know, we are building support in Massachusetts. We get a 1,600 megawatt target, and we build, then New York does 2,400, and then New Jersey, once Christie left, bumped its sort of aspirational target up to 3,600. They're bickering over who has the best target and which one has the most integrity. So they're sort of fighting over it. And now it's starting to spill south, as we've seen. In Maryland, well, Maryland is sort of one of the leaders at the beginning, and then just recently Virginia announced a goal of 2,000 megawatts by 2028. So it's been a long slog, but the good news is we finally got the first one a couple years ago, and then the most recent announcement of the Massachusetts, the cost of the Massachusetts one, I think, not just raised eyebrows, I think I would argue it's a game changer. But there's still a lot of resistance and a lot of learning that needs to happen about when the wind blows and how to manage all that. So anyway, we're working hard on that.
Stephanie?
Well, first I want to thank Justin for inviting me to speak here, and thanks for all your good work on offshore wind, and also thanks to any of you all out here who have an interest in offshore wind and have written about offshore wind. And I will note Derek Jackson, who has been at this longer than I have and has really done some great work. So my name is Stephanie McClellan, and I direct a program called the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind. And rather than sort of be repetitive about sort of the trends that we're seeing, that I see in offshore wind, let me just talk to you a little bit about what we've done, and sort of that can at least provide some perspective on what it is that I'm bringing to this conversation. So just in terms of my background, I have in 2008 to 2011, I served as Governor Jack Markell's policy director, notable because Delaware had the first power purchase agreement for offshore wind in the country. Everyone's always talked about Cape Wind as being the first big project, but Delaware actually had gone out there and supported a project, which of course did not come to fruition. But when I was in the governor's office, I got tagged as the point person on that. So that put me in touch with the range of state policymakers and federal policymakers all up and down the East Coast who were working to advance this in a very, very early stage a decade ago. From there, I moved on to work in private industry. I worked for the Atlantic Wind Connection, which is a proposed offshore transmission line, which would move 7,000 megawatts of offshore wind between four different states, and is seen as a real game changer in terms of providing major infrastructure for the state. So I worked for them for a couple of years, at which time the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, a private foundation, came to me and said, we need, this was at a time, and I'm talking to Derek, I think the first time Derek ever interviewed me was right when we got launched. It was a terrible time in offshore wind. Cape Wind had had its power purchase agreements withdrawn. The Blue Water Wind Project in Delaware had its power purchase agreement withdrawn by the utilities. We just saw everything was just, Block Island couldn't get built, couldn't get off the ground yet. And so it was this real moment of, is this going to happen or not? And so the Rockefeller Brothers Fund came to me and said, we really want to have a program that will work at the intersection between policymakers and industry and with NGOs, but to really kind of identify what those hurdles are. Why are these states sitting on the sidelines right now? And what do they need to be able to overcome those hurdles? So we created the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, which is housed at the University of Delaware. And so what we've done is I'm going to say it really in three things. One is we've served as an analyst as well as expert resource for states from Massachusetts down to Virginia, focusing in on Massachusetts and New York, really providing game-changing analysis that they could see that art of the possible with numbers behind it. Here's what you can do. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's how it's going to impact your ratepayers. You can do this, and here's the actions you can take that actually put this in your control. You're not just sort of jumping into the water without really knowing what you can do, whether or not these projects that you want to have, if you can sink or swim with them. Secondly, we really served as a knowledge bridge between European regulators, European experts, big European offshore wind developers who had tremendous amount of experience and knowledge in this that we would bring and connect with U.S. policymakers. At the time, the U.S. policymakers would say, we've got these environmentalists knocking on our door saying you ought to do offshore wind, but we can't figure out why we would do that. It's too expensive, and the only developers that are talking to us have never built anything before. So we had to make sure that these, that they were hearing from the people who have built and met, hundreds and thousands of turbines they put in the water. So we created that knowledge bridge as well. The other thing that we did is to really bring the sector together. And when I say the sector, I don't mean industry, but I mean the sector, meaning industry, NGOs, state and federal policymakers, to really identify strategic directions and to bear down on a few strategic opportunities like Massachusetts and New York to really turn the levers and get those policies underway. The last thing that we've done, which may or may not come up in this conversation, is when the November 16 elections happened, there were many in the offshore wind field who felt like, oh my gosh, the only renewable energy that Donald Trump has any experience with is offshore wind and the project off of his golf course in Scotland that he fought. He's going to kill us. What are we going to do? And so we then, Special Initiative, then began a year-and-a-half-long campaign to really make sure that the Trump administration understands the synergies between their agenda for energy independence, energy security, energy dominance, and how offshore wind really fulfills those goals, and also the synergies between offshore wind and the U.S. offshore energy industry, meaning those oil and gas companies, as well as other component companies for the land-based wind industry in the central U.S., and how this is not just an East Coast story or a coastal elites story, but it's rather something that's really going to drive economic benefits throughout the state. So I'm happy to be here kind of as a longtime observer, analyst, and policy advocate for this. So again, thanks.
Josh?
Thank you, Justin. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for being here. My name is Josh Cohen. I'm with the Business Network for Offshore Wind, which is the nation's only national 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to advancing the offshore wind industry and its supply chain. Our focus is on businesses, primarily and on jobs and making those supply chain connections. I'm relatively new to offshore wind, but the network got its start in Maryland several years ago, and the network really started as part of Maryland's own effort back in the days when Maryland was leading the pack to provide a business voice for the legislature to help say, hey, there's a business case to support offshore wind in Maryland. If I leave you with one takeaway today, it's that offshore wind is a reality and it's happening fast. So if your frame of reference as folks who've kind of followed offshore wind tangentially and are familiar with the Cape Wind saga, or if you're familiar with the Black Island Wind Farm and it's like, well, what else is there? I hope you come away from this panel with, if nothing else, with a realization that, oh my gosh, not only is it happening, it's happening very quickly. And in just a few years from now, we're going to start seeing a lot of power being generated off the Atlantic coast. A couple business network announcements. One is, if any of you are podcast listeners, you have this flyer in front of you. The network just launched a podcast last week for National Clean Energy Week that's going to feature interviews with movers and shakers. Our first three episodes are up with Jeff Grabowski from Deepwater Wind, with the two guys who are leading the effort for Nautilus Wind, the small project off of Atlantic City, and with the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities President Joe Fiordaliso. That's announcement number one. Announcement number two is the network's big annual event is called the IPF, which stands for the International Offshore Wind Partnering Forum. It's a horrible name, but it's the IPF. It'll be next April in New York City. Alicia Barton and NYSERDA are co-hosting it. And if any of you are credentialed reporters and want to attend, just you can give me your card, you can follow the website, and when we start opening up the registration, I'll make sure each of you can attend who wants to. There's other points I can make, but I think why don't I just leave it there for now and turn it back to you, Justin.
Great. Thanks, Josh. So I'll just start with a few questions to get the conversation going, but I'll make sure to leave plenty of time for all your questions as well. So Stephanie, you started to hint at this, so I'm going to ask, maybe talk about the posture of the Trump administration toward the offshore wind sector. As a reporter covering the industry, it seems to me it's been pretty much business as usual. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is the main federal agency responsible for permitting and running the auctions for these projects, you know, to my observation, seems to be going along as it was before during the Obama administration. So it may seem like offshore wind is the one renewable energy sector that the Trump administration, if not disfavors, at least is letting go. So maybe comment on that.
Yeah. You know, I think just to clarify, so the, you know, offshore wind farms are built typically 10 to 15 miles offshore in federal waters. And that is the Department of Interior, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. They control that. They lease it, and then they permit anything that is built on the OCS and federal waters. So because of that, the offshore wind industry is inherently dependent upon the federal government in a way that, say, a solar project might be. So at the other end of the spectrum, though, the states also have an incredibly huge role in making sure that there's opportunities, that there's a market there to sell power. So you get your power contracts from approved at the state level, you get your site control and where you're going to build it from the federal government. So it's really, really important that the federal government has a very important role in this. And I would absolutely say, Justin, that we have been, not only is it business as usual, they have gone steps further beyond, you know, where we thought that they would, where even a next Democratic administration perhaps might go. So looking at the streamlining of the permitting regime, and of course in a way that is environmentally responsible, is the key to make sure that this is done right. But also taking a look at innovative and new opportunities to really make sure that offshore wind development can be as efficient and low cost as possible. So that's within the Interior Department. We'll see another lease auction the end of this year for areas off the coast of Massachusetts. They've already held a lease auction North Carolina under this new administration. And so those keep coming, and that's a really, really important step. I think it's also important to note that the Department of Energy, not just in Interior, but also Rick Perry's Department of Energy, they just created a research and development consortium that they awarded that to New York State, who is leading it, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. So that will really create the first public-private partnership for research and development for offshore wind. So we see it in multiple areas, not just, so we can't kind of pigeonhole it as just, Ryan Zinke gets it. You know, it's actually in administration-wide support for this. So we've been really, really pleased. And, you know, the rubber will meet the road in the next year. You know, the Vineyard Wind Project that that you've mentioned, which is the 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour, that has to go through the federal permitting process. There's not been an offshore wind project that's gone through the federal permitting process. So we'll really see whether or not all of this goodwill really translates into a smooth process, but we have every reason to think it will.
You have anything to add, either Rob
I would just add one thing, which is I agree with everything Stephanie said, and you know, and I guess we're sort of surprised. But what I would say is there was a lot of work done in the early days to get the sort of climate people that if it's a climate solution to hell with the critters type, you know, dynamic. Really to spend a lot of time making sure that the environmental community was united. I'd say the majority of the environmental community has been bullish on offshore wind for a long time, but there's some legitimate questions that need to be asked about impacts on ecosystems and other things that, you know, we needed to make sure sometimes some of our people didn't get out front. Now, too far with it and create kind of a rift that would undercut things. And I think the Obama administration was more sensitive to that than the Trump administration would likely be. I'm just guessing, but so far it looks like they're not, and luckily they're not doing sort of the generic environmental reviews of the areas. Yeah. that all happened already. So,
and just one other point that I think is always important to add is that the original rules for the offshore wind program, leasing and permitting program, they were actually written under the George W. Bush administration. And so this has been a bipartisan endeavor from the beginning. It was the Obama administration that got it over the finish line. But, you know, that's something that I'm, you know, I think has been under noted, is that this has always been bipartisan and can be bipartisan.
Are there non-bipartisan elements in this? Are there points of view that...
Let's go ahead and wait and hold the questions until...
He's going to do more questions. You're going to do more questions.
Yeah, just hold on for a few. And let me remind you, when we do get to the questions, please state your name and your affiliation, and SCJ members and working journalists get to go first. Josh, did you have anything you wanted to add on that?
I would just echo... what's already been said. Secretary Zinke was a plenary speaker at last year's IPF. The room was packed. He took questions. He had the questions you'd expect about why is the administration allowing offshore drilling off the coasts? And, you know, he took some non-friendly questions, but he had a very strong message, which is what Stephanie said, which is that the administration sees offshore wind as part of an all-of-the-above strategy. And when you think about who was in the audience, there were 600 people there, and there were a lot of business and industry leaders, not just domestic American ones, but from foreign countries, who wanted and needed to hear a clear message from our federal government that they were supporting offshore wind moving forward, because we're talking tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of investment that's at stake.
Okay. Yeah, let me just get through a couple more questions, and then we'll return to you guys. One, I'm curious, and I interviewed you about this earlier this year, Stephanie, and that was there had been a bill introduced by Senators Carper and Collins that was going to put in place investment tax credit specifically for offshore wind. It was for the first 3 gigawatts of projects deployed. The existing federal tax credits for wind are on a phase-out, so the concern has been that because the offshore sector is getting started later, you know, these projects need federal support. So my question to you guys is, what kind of federal support, if any, do you think is necessary to jumpstart the industry, or are the state incentives that exist going to be enough?
I have thoughts. I mean, I think all forms of renewable energy will be able to survive without subsidies at some point, unlike some of the incumbent industries. And I do think that it's a fair point, and we supported and tried to, were encouraging of Carper and Collins. It was an ITC, right? It was the nature of offshore wind was such that instead of it being a production tax credit, it made more sense for it to be an investment tax credit to have an incentive to jumpstart things, really. And so I think, you know, we're right. I think it would be very helpful, and it would help accelerate things. But I think, you know, like with most of the clean energy technologies that are moving forward, we're nearing a tipping point. This is just a little further behind. So,
I mean, I would agree with that, and I remember that conversation, Justin. And you know, I kept saying it's an accelerant, you know, but it's not the only one that's out there. And so, if we don't have that, then it's not a do or die situation. You know, states like New York and New Jersey are putting out RFPs. Actually, New Jersey already has put out a RFP for power just a couple of, I don't know, maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago. New York will have one out by the end of October, early November. The reason why they're doing that, and that's about 2,000 megawatts of offshore wind that they will be procuring over the next year. The reason why they're on that accelerated timetable is because they want those projects to be able to be eligible for tax credits. So, you know, it's a nice way in which the state government realizes the importance of the federal government and how these two groups can work together to really jumpstart this industry. But I guess I would say that as a jumpstart, that the industry already is jumpstarted, and that the developers that I work with from Massachusetts on down have not been thinking about this as an industry that's going to be dependent on tax credits. So in terms of when they're doing their calculations, they're sharpening their pencils. You know, sure, if it's there, that's great, but I can't depend on that.
Great. Josh, anything to add?
No.
Okay. Great. Let's go ahead and open up to two questions. Start, Derek, at the end here. And please, again, state your name and your affiliation.
Derek Jackson, Union Concerned Scientist and former columnist of Boston Globe. Once upon a time, Massachusetts thought it would be the center, the hub of an offshore wind universe, whether it was Cape Wind before or the Massachusetts being the first state to forget New Jersey, Christie, Barry, the 1,100 megawatts. Massachusetts being the first state to have a large commitment to offshore wind. Now that you have 2,400 in New York, 3,500 in Jersey, now 2,000 in Virginia, has that changed the dynamics of where the center of the offshore wind industry is going to be in the United States? And how do you see that competition shaping up for ports, for the business part of the industry?
Okay, let me repeat that for the recording. So a question from the audience. Massachusetts was thought to be an early leader in offshore wind with the Cape Wind project. With its failure and now with some upstart states in the picture, does the center of gravity change for offshore wind industry on the East Coast?
So I know I have my answer.
I would say yes, as it should. I mean, we want the center of gravity to be relatively diffuse, and so and that's a good thing. And you know, and there's plenty of offshore wind goodies to go around. And so, you know, do you want 100% of a small pie, or do you want 10% of a pie that's 100 times bigger, right? So I think that's what's happening, and it's a good thing, and it's creating a race to the top, and it's encouraging some of the states that have been on the sidelines from it's encouraging them to jump in. They're seeing a train leaving the station that they're going to miss. And so that combined with all the other factors that make it all more appealing, it's cheap, you know, and obviously we like the pollution-free part of it as people are trying to figure out how to meet targets. So, yeah.
A couple of key points. I think, one, Massachusetts will be rewarded for its first mover status. So I think that, you know, the industry certainly understands that that jump-started a lot of other activities in these other states, as Rob is saying. But also the industry has to have efficient and properly located and developed infrastructure to be able to do its job and to sort of unleash the powers of the market and bring those projects in at the lowest cost. So kind of the idea that because you were the first or because you're the biggest, that somehow you're going to become the locus of operations is going to kind of bump up against the economic needs of the industry as it develops. So those are just kind of two thoughts about just generally. But in terms of where we're headed with this, the way that I really see this shaping up is I think we're going to start to see regions, states, form together as regions and really compete in kind of who can be the regional powerhouse. So rather than every state on its own, because if you think about it right now, 3.2 gigawatts in Massachusetts is not that different from 3.5 gigawatts in New Jersey, which isn't that different from 2.4 gigawatts in New York. They're each on equal footing almost. And so if they don't start to see that their competitive advantage and that their competitive edge lies in what they have as a region and what they're going to be competing with, whether or not it be south of Virginia, in the mid-Atlantic, or in the Northeast, you know, they're going to be left behind. And so I think you see some of the smarter, I shouldn't say smarter states, you see some of the states start to behave like this. So Massachusetts and Rhode Island, for example, teamed up on procurement, making a larger procurement than just Massachusetts could. You see New York and New Jersey New Jersey and Delaware trying to figure out how can we work together. And I think that the same thing certainly will happen in Maryland and Virginia and other states like that. So I think it's going to look very different. I think that competition is going to look very different than it looked in the beginning, because they've got to take the market and market scale and competition to the next level because of where we've gotten to right now.
It's a really interesting question, because it speaks to one of the reasons why offshore wind is so dynamic and changing and so interesting right now. So if you're asking, like, how do we see it playing out, I don't know. If you know, I want to hear what your thoughts are, because a year ago, I don't think anyone would have expected that we would have seen these just like state after state come out to the extent to where we are today with their targets. And when you talk about port development, this is where, from the business network standpoint, we have a lot, you know, that's our bread and butter to a large extent, is the local businesses and local jobs that are created, and ports obviously are essential. But from the state standpoint, it's not just about having governors and legislatures say, we have this renewable portfolio standard target, or we have this offshore wind target for clean energy. It's really one of the reasons why we're seeing this kind of friendly competition is because the states want this investment, like has been said. And so, for instance, when a state awards a contract, when a state awards the OREC, the Offshore Renewable Energy Credits, which provides the financial predictability to a developer so that they can move forward and finance the project, there are strings attached. So for Maryland, last year, Maryland awarded two contracts to Deepwater Wind and U.S. Wind, totaling 368 megawatts, which once upon a time was a lot, now not so much. But as part of that contract with the Public Service Commission, the developers collectively have to invest over $100 million back in the state. I think $30-some million in port upgrades and another $70-some million in other economic investment and grants that goes back into workforce training. And so part of the prize for the states is not just, the green clean energy checkmark. It's really the jobs and the investment that go with that.
But can I just clarify that Maryland to date is the only state that's done that. Massachusetts has not, and in legislation made very, it was very, very clear to not do that.
Yeah.
New York, while they certainly in their draft RFP for power say we want to know that developers are talking to New York's suppliers that could participate, there's not that kind of requirement because
right.
it doesn't, those local content requirements can actually just drive up the cost of power and not necessary. So, Maryland has done a great job
right.
to try to anchor some of that supply chain in its state, but it's not necessarily how the other states are going to do
right.
that.
And just to continue on that point, the biggest predictor, I would say, in terms of which state is going to become that, not necessarily a coastal hub, but at least a regional hub, in my opinion, is going to be related to what their overall target is, because it's all about scale. So if you're a developer and you are saying, well, it's more economical to invest in, manufacturing the foundation or the transition pieces somewhere on the East Coast, are you going to do it in a state that has no offshore wind target or a minimal offshore wind target, or are you going to do it in a state like New Jersey, which not only has this 3,500 megawatt target, but like Stephanie is saying, just a couple weeks ago they released their solicitation for the first 1,100 megawatts, and at the same time Governor Murphy is saying, and oh, by the way, 2 years from now we're going to release a solicitation for 1,200 more, and then 2 years after that, 1,200 more. So if you're the developer saying, well, am I going to really base my port operations in New Jersey or New Bedford, or, you're looking at what the pipeline is.
But that's the predictability of the market,
mm-hmm.
not the size of the market. Because Massachusetts, in the summer, Governor Baker signed a law that will lead to Massachusetts having a 3.2 gigawatt market
right.
size. So I'm just saying that when these states all become sort of on equal footing, and the predictability of the market and the implementation of policy is super, super important. But I just think that it won't be the size of that target. It'll be state actions to implement it, as well as important infrastructure that actually helps these developers to produce and deliver lower cost projects. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Here in the end.
Thank you. My name is Dave Abel. I'm a reporter at the Boston Globe. I cover environmental issues and wind issues for the paper. Just to come back to the question I was asking earlier, is there any partisan distinction between what the left versus the right is calling for in terms of their vision for offshore wind? The second question is, given all of the concerns that we're having about natural gas now, which is the predominant source of energy in the Northeast, do you see any effort to accelerate offshore wind, and why, given if we're at 6.5 cents and falling, why is Massachusetts, for example, at seemingly measly 1,400 megawatts of offshore wind? Why, this is not a unproven technology. This is something we know how to produce. Why can't we scale up to 5,000 megawatts? I mean, if Jersey is going for 3,500, what is holding us back from moving more aggressively? Do you see that happen?
For the recording, from a question from the audience, is there a partisan distinction, left-right, on offshore wind? And second part, with the falling cost of offshore wind, why aren't states being even more aggressive with their deployment targets?
I would just say on the partisan distinction, you mean within state administrations? Is that – or? You said left and right, so I'm not sure what that meant exactly. But I think that some of those distinctions are eroding, and they're related to your second question, I think, which is that, I remember in Massachusetts there was a 250 megawatt solar cap. And at one point we started to say, let's push the then administration to, the Patrick administration to increase that. And very quickly, they came in with something that was higher than what the advocates had been asking for. And lo and behold, they kept meeting those. And I think it was the same dynamic. It's expensive. How do we figure it out? How do we integrate it into the system? And then in this case, I think we've made tremendous headway. And I'll use Mass as the example, where the original energy plan of the administration, I think, was really like build a transmission line to Hydro-Quebec and build a gas pipeline. That was the energy plan, with some little trinkets of renewables on it. And I think, I think that's just totally changed for all the reasons that these people have mentioned. The prices are coming down. The industry supports it. There's more industry people supporting it and seeing where they want the future of the state or the region to go. So I think that that's what we're starting to see happen, and I think there's every reason that we should. We already have seen. 2 years ago, they did 1,600 megawatt. They just expanded it, and they're looking at what New Jersey's doing. They're realizing maybe they're not going to get their gas pipeline for a lot of reasons that we would agree with. And then, you know, and the price of these things are coming down. The understanding of how it integrates into the grid is getting greater, so people feel more comfortable with, you know, how it plays out. So I think we're seeing that happen.
I think as I understand your question in terms of, is there a division in what the left and the right want out of offshore wind? Is there a difference in that? And does that make it somehow then there's a limitation in the bipartisanship? Is that what I understood? Because I think that right now it's where the left and the right are aligned, right? It's kind of one of the only places. without naming the group, I will say that I was recently on a phone call with the national field organizer for a very, very, very conservative group, talking about offshore wind and getting offshore wind on an agenda at a conservative clean energy summit in Washington, D.C. And the first question was, is offshore wind the political project of the left? And it was like, not at all. Not at all. But so I think that there's this sort of patina, because it was seen as this kind of environmental cause of the left during the Obama administration. And it still might be an environmental cause, but that doesn't mean that the left owns it. So right now, it's this kind of desired path on both the left and the right. And I want to be really careful how I say this, because, you know, I think that, you know, what environmentalists want out of offshore wind is what, you know, I as an industry analyst and observer want, and what probably the business network wants, what every developer that I know wants, and that is responsibly sited, environmentally responsible offshore wind. And I think if there were any movement towards trying to change NEPA laws or change certain aspects to protect right whales, for example, you would see that split immediately. But that has not happened. We have not seen that there are any movements in this administration or on Capitol Hill to gut any of those kinds of laws, to sort of the race to the bottom in environmental regulation. So could it happen? It could, if that were the direction that we're going, but we haven't seen that at all.
Yeah, I'd say it's political with a little p. It still depends on what the situation is on the ground and what the particular dynamic is in the state. But it's not so much a partisan political difference anymore. And in fact, I don't know if this is the organization you're talking about, but there's this group called CREST, the Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions, which is a right-leaning organization that supports Republican candidates who favor clean energy. And there's so we see a lot of alignment in terms of Republican and Democratic priorities.
And I just want to, on your second question of what's holding us back from going even bigger, you know, the reason that early target of 1.6 gigawatts or in 2,400 megawatts, right, is that these state policymakers they understood from European experience that to be able to get projects built at lower cost, they had to show there was going to be a continuous market for their product. And so those were sort of these market visibility signals that were sent. And in none of those states that I'm aware of were they ever seen as the upper boundary. They were, what's a sufficient market and duration of that market that will start to send the signal that the United States is real and in the game. And I think that, you know, again, developers that I work with, they're very clear. We're not looking for continuous policies of carve-outs and special treatment, but that once that price point becomes something that's not an aberration, that this just becomes competitive power, just in the same way that land-based wind is now in the middle of the country. That offshore wind can be that on the East Coast, and that when it is that, that's when it will become just yet another energy source that gets bid in and competes with everybody else.
Yeah. But another, I mean, to the second part of your question, building an offshore wind farm takes time. Like, if we start today, it could be 5 years before you have steel in the water and the turbine spinning. So I believe 5 to 10 years from now, we'll be at the point where you see legislatures like genuinely trying, making some of these, you know, trade-offs or weighing some of these competing energy sources, like you asked in your question about natural gas and others. But right now, we're not there. We will be there in 5 years or so.
Great. Right here in the front row.
Christine Heinrichs, freelancer at the Voyager Press. I'm asking about West Coast. There's a large wind offshore floating wind farm planned for right offshore. There's concerns about environmental impacts from that because it's just outside the National Marine Sanctuary and right in a major migration corridor. We're kind of waiting to see what High Wind off Scotland has had, what their results are. What do you see as the prospects for that?
So a question from the audience asking about potential environmental impacts for proposed floating offshore wind projects along the California coast close to national marine sanctuaries.
I could start and say with any offshore wind farm, just like Stephanie was saying in terms of, you know, the characteristics we want of any clean energy development, with any offshore wind farm, whether it's a fixed foundation farm or with floating turbines, we want to make sure that it's deconflicted not only with environmental concerns, but with military, in Southern California in particular. As you know, there's a huge military presence. When developers get approvals to construct the wind farms, it's not just about the location to avoid, you know, certain marine and habitat. It also has to do with the time of year. You know, you can't be drilling during this time of year because of migratory or reproductive or other things. So that's an issue wherever. But is it solvable? Absolutely. I think with California, the main difference, obviously, between the East and West Coast is that the East Coast has a continental shelf that is shallower and slopes going out several miles. So with today's existing technology of fixed foundations, you can build turbines, in water that's 60 to 100 meters deep off the East Coast. Off the West Coast, you don't have that luxury. So we are waiting for floating turbine technology to really become commercially viable at scale. I think we're all looking towards the High Wind example off the coast of Scotland. The preliminary indications are excellent. It's a relatively small project. I think it powers 20 or 30,000 homes, but the capacity factor so far is 65%, which dwarfs any on-land or offshore turbines in the world. So its power capacity is really promising. And NREL, National Renewable Energy Laboratory, they did a national wind resource a couple years ago. And to Rob's point about the East Coast, where the East Coast has enough wind potential to power the country, California does too. Its net offshore wind capacity, NREL estimates at 112 gigawatts, and that's after you take away from military and other areas. Its net energy potential is 392 terawatt hours, which is 100 terawatt hours more than California used all of last year. So it will happen in terms of the wind resource. Really, Northern California and Oregon are where the wind resource is strongest.
They both have onshore projects.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, the area that you're talking about, and I think the Central Coast,
right.
You know, right now there's a lot more attention being paid than was once before off of Humboldt County, where the wind resource is great, but the transmission system is poor. And so, you know, that's going to be, I think, the biggest obstacle is to, and again, we don't know what the impact of large-scale floating floating cables are on migratory mammals, for example, marine mammals. But I think the bigger constraint that we is probably really going to play a role right now is these transmission constraints. And so whether or not those transmission constraints can be addressed will be, I think, and how timely that will be. So what is what the market will bear.
Clint.
Yeah, Clint Wilder, senior editor of Clean Edge. What was so wrong with Cape Wind, and do you think that that was and do you think that that was a big setback for the industry, or provided, you know, lessons learned to
So, question from the audience. Question from the audience: What was wrong with Cape Wind? Why did it fail? And were there any lessons learned for the U.S. wind industry?
Somebody ought to write a book about that.
Someone has.
I know.
Okay.
I don't think there was anything wrong with Cape Wind. I think we were strong supporters of. Well, let's put it this way. It was first. It was too close to shore, probably, and there was strong support for it on the Cape. Unfortunately, the narrower opposition was slightly more financed than the stronger support. I think that much of the rest of the industry is benefiting greatly from the toils of, you know, whether it's figuring out how to measure this or that, or, you know, all of that, and then giving the agencies an opportunity to kick the tires and develop protocols. But it just, I guess, you know, hindsight's 2020, the time wasn't right, and probably the location wasn't right, and some combination of it was probably a little too close, and certainly a little too close to the wrong people. But I will say, honestly, that I'm unaware of any project, dirty or clean, that has had more money spent against it. So I'm not sure if we spent $300 million fighting Vineyard Wind or any other offshore wind project, that it would make it, right? So you do have to factor that in.
But, right, and I agree with that. I would say that from a meteorological perspective, Cape Wind was brilliant. It was in shallow water. It was close to shore. Meaning that there was not a high transmission cost or O&M cost because of that. There were was great wind resource, but politically, it was a disaster. And so, you know, they wouldn't spend $300 million fighting Vineyard Wind because Vineyard Wind wasn't put in a place that was a political disaster. So, so I think that was its fatal flaw. But I do think that, you know, the regulatory protocols in the federal government were developed because of Cape Wind. We wouldn't have those. They wouldn't have gotten written. And I think something that's probably not like a super sexy thing to talk about, but the amount of people and human resources that have gone through not only the Cape Wind project, but the Blue Water Wind project, these failed projects, these people now work for all of these successful developers. So they created a community, not only an educated community of regulators who developed and then went through regulatory processes, they developed a community of offshore wind expertise and offshore wind advocates that are moving this forward today. So we stand on all of their shoulders. That's how I feel.
Arguably, it also delayed the process of offshore wind by a decade. I mean, because of the intractable battles that...
I disagree with that. I think what delayed offshore wind by a decade was its price. Having worked from governor's offices and legislatures from Massachusetts down to Virginia during that time period, I would hear people like, we don't want a Cape Wind, that's for sure. But that wasn't the reason why they didn't move forward. Once that price point was demonstrated to be dropping in Europe as swiftly and rapidly and steeply as it was, that's when they all of a sudden started to take notice. And I think the commissioning of Block Island, showing an offshore wind farm can get built in the U.S., it kind of countered the narrative of Cape Wind. But I don't think that that's what really kept it from moving forward solely.
Did you have a question, Maria?
Oh, yeah. Maria Galigian with Freelance Journals. Actually, that's kind of my question. Is I was curious to hear, with the Block Island project actually being up and running, it's 5 turbines or 30 megawatts. What has the industry been able to learn from that? And how has it really had much of an impact in moving forward for other projects? And also, I noticed that if we have to talk about Deepwater Wind as a developer, too, because I see they're the only ones, I think, with the project that are out of finance.
Yeah, so a question from the audience. Has there been any industry learnings from the one existing offshore wind project in the United States, the Block Island project?
I would say, yeah, without question. They're very valuable for the not just for the industry, but for the whole regulatory framework for offshore wind. Like you say, Block Island is 5 turbines, 30 megawatts. Nautilus Wind, which was formerly known as the Fisherman's Atlantic City Wind Farm, which is before the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities now, is 3 turbines. I think it's just under 3 miles right off of Atlantic City. Dominion Energy has a similar project that's going to be a little farther out, but it's only 2 turbines. And so from an industry standpoint, when you think about all that's involved in launching a new industry, these projects are really helpful so that we crawl before we walk, before we run. So, and that's why it's so critical that the projects work well. I mean, if Block Island was commissioned and then it had all these problems, that would not be good for investors who want to, you know, minimize their risk. That's why it's really important. Start small. It's not just about the developers. It's about ports. How are ports going to stage things? It's about public utility commissions. How are they going to handle OREX or PPAs, legislatures? So that's why we're not just doing individual projects. We're really building a whole industry with these smaller projects.
I think the greatest contribution, I mean, that notwithstanding, I think the greatest contribution that Block Island made is what I was just referring to, and that is helping to rewrite the narrative of offshore wind in the United States, because Cape Wind dominated that narrative. Having been in Europe back in the early part of this decade and trying to get companies like Dong Energy to come over here and play, and not just, you know, just come and talk to these people about it so that they can realize that it's real, and they were just like, you can't build offshore wind in the United States, and then refer to Cape Wind. So it really provided confidence and rewrote that narrative. And then that confidence is what translates to lower investor cost. If they see projects as highly risky, like every single project's going to have 20 lawsuits against it, the developer might move forward, but the financing for that is going to be very, very expensive because it'll be considered a high-risk project. The lower the risk, the lower the cost. So we're benefiting from that in a really, really important way. I think it was a huge game changer. But Deepwater Wind, you had a question about Deepwater Wind?
Oh, just I'm curious if there, because I saw the projects that are financed, or on the sheet, sorry, if they're the ones behind most of them. I just wondered if they, are there other big developers too that are?
So Vineyard Wind actually is the one. They're the one, the 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour project that's up in off the coast of Massachusetts. It's 800 megawatts. So it's a very sizable contract. But right now, those guys and Deepwater Wind are the only two developers that have contracts.
Okay. Way up at the top row.
Hi, I'm Annie Blair. I'm an environmental journalist based at Miami University of Ohio. 10 years ago, I was reporting on offshore wind in Lowestoft, which is on the UK's Suffolk coast. It's a port city for the Greater Gather, the enormous wind farm there. And one of the things that turned up there in my reporting was workforce development and the issue of finding these very specialized workers for those turbines. And I'm wondering if you would consider that to be something that should be built into the permitting or the contract policies. I think one of you mentioned that one contract maybe has workforce development as part of it. It's a pretty specialized field. I don't know how you're incorporating that.
Great. Question from the audience about, based on the experience in the UK where there's a very mature offshore wind sector? What about questions of workforce development in the United States in our nascent industry?
Sure. So for context, when you think about the types of jobs and industries that are involved in offshore wind, when you think about just the wind farm itself, you have the foundation, which is the part that connects to the seabed. You have the transition piece. You have the tower. You have the rotors, the turbines. Then you have the whole electricity grid part of it. For some wind farms, the substation is offshore, the primary one. Others, it connects offshore, comes onshore, and there's cabling, there's transmission issues. And then you have all of the industry occupations that are involved in it, from fabrication to painting to engineering to logistics to operations and maintenance. It's a huge driver of jobs. And so one of the interesting aspects of offshore wind is that a lot of the industries and job skills for offshore gas and oil are transferable. With Block Island, for instance, the foundations were manufactured by Gulf Island Fabricators in Louisiana, which has, you know, got its experience manufacturing offshore oil rigs. In Maryland, there's this this hundreds of vacant acres. It used to be the Bethlehem Steel facility, and then the former Sparrows Point shipyard, and hundreds of acres of that are set aside. It's deep water. It's, you know, right off the Chesapeake Bay as a staging area for some sort of, you know, some aspects of offshore wind. And so there you have, like, literally you have a real life example of a 20th century industry that's gone now that is in the process of being repurposed for a 21st century industry. So,
but your answer would be no, that it should be built into the permanent.
So my answer is yes. And so I was kind of just kind of painting a picture for context. And so in Maryland, some of the required investment that the developers have to make goes back into paying for grants, workforce development grants. Some of it's supply chain geared towards businesses. Others, it's geared towards actual jobs and getting skills and certifications. NYSERDA just made an announcement that they are releasing several million dollars of grants, some of which are targeted towards community colleges and technical colleges. Others have different parameters. I don't know off the top of my head if that money is coming out of the state, you know, what the source of that money is, if it's developed.
It's the Clean Energy Fund.
It's the Clean Energy Fund.
It is.
Yeah. So, I would say that I don't think that it's necessarily something that should be built into a revenue contract, is to say, here's your requirement to do workforce development. That workforce development has to get done.
I see.
But in Massachusetts, for example, they just had a general economic benefits, you know, sort of 70% of your bid is going to be graded on cost, 20% on economic benefits, 10% on project viability. New York is something similar like that. So within that kind of economic benefits that they're evaluating, there's all different kinds of things that it leaves the flexibility, and it allows the developers and the industry to sort of identify what their major needs are in that state and to get it done. So, for example, in Massachusetts, the winning bid created a workforce development program at, I think, Bristol Community College. Anybody from Massachusetts, did I get that right? Bristol County, Bristol Community College, something like that. And then there are these kinds of public-private partnerships with, you know, the state. NYSERDA put $15 million into workforce development. Maryland sort of did it in a combination way. So my feeling is just the more flexibility for developers to meet those economic benefits tests without prescribing to them how to do it.
Yeah.
The better we're going to have the industry's needs met, rather than trying to prescribe what they're going to be and how they're going to be developed.
That's what I meant.
It's like we have time for probably a couple more questions since we got started late. Way up in the top row. Yes.
I'm Dave Folsom of Michigan State University. I'm also on the board of SEJ. And, you know, I'm just thinking it just seems incredibly odd to me that we have the offshore wind panel in the heart of the longest coastline in North America, and yet no one wants to address that. And you know, we're used to East Coast bias. But why is this? Are we just that interesting? I mean, I get bombarded all the time, usually controversial on the region. No, we don't need a bunch of East Coast journalists to talk East Coast sources in the Midwest. We kind of like know what's going on here.
Okay, so question from the audience. We're here in Flint, Michigan, close to the Great Lakes. What about discussion about projects on the Great Lakes?
I would just say, so good point. but then also, I would say that in this part of the country, the East Coast doesn't have a lot of places to put renewable energy, and so it's uniquely there's a whole bunch of factors that I think attributes it has that make it uniquely suited for offshore wind. Shallow water near major population areas, so you don't have as much of the issues that we're talking about in California with transmission and others. So, so that said, we should talk about doing it here too in this part of the country and other places. Again, with a sensitivity to trade-offs on the environment and other things. And but I also am the resource is not as big, so the wind doesn't blow as hard, which means it will cost more, among other things. And then, right, I mean, that's another factor.
And as somebody said earlier, maybe it was Josh who said something about sort of rolling down the East Coast. And I tend to see this kind of rolling effect that will happen through various parts of the country. As that price point drops for offshore wind, then it can become competitive in areas where today it might not be. So why would anybody want to build an offshore wind farm in the Great Lakes off of Michigan when you have access to homegrown Michigan land-based wind that's going to be still a fraction of the price of offshore wind? But once that price point comes down, there isn't, again, environmental considerations. But I think it starts in the part of the country where it's competitive now. The price point drops as we build that scale and build out a supply chain, and then it rolls through into the Gulf of Mexico, up to the Great Lakes, and but we're just not quite there yet in terms of the cost.
There is one project called Icebreaker Wind you're familiar with in Lake Erie, and they just there was
it,
it's
and I'm not convinced that the Canadians agree with you.
Yeah, Icebreaker is small. I think it's 6 turbines, 20 megawatts, but they just had a major milestone where I forget if it was U.S. Fish and Wildlife or there was a 2-year environmental study. And there was a finding of no significant impact. So that is moving forward off of Cleveland, off the shore of Cleveland.
I know we met with Jim Lehner with the Jelen Wind about a prospective project.
I'm sure there's interest all over.
I think I saw a question in front row.
I'd like to see Jim get a
John Kutcher, University of Colorado and Solar Today Magazine. Along those lines of the reason there isn't interest in wind on the Great Lakes is because you have access to cheaper land-based wind. It used to be said that offshore wind is roughly about 3 times the cost of onshore wind in terms of cents per kilowatt hour, dollars per megawatt hour, whatever. Both have come down dramatically in price. Is that ratio of 3 still something that gets thrown around? Or what do you think is the cost penalty of offshore compared to onshore now?
Question from the audience with the cost declines in both onshore and offshore wind. What's the ratio of cost comparing the two? It used to be that onshore was significantly cheaper.
I don't think that we know yet what the real cost of offshore wind is going to be in this country yet. I think the 6.5 cent kilowatt hour is a game changer, a head spinner, whatever else you want to call it. But I don't know that that's reflective of what we're going to see all other offshore wind farms coming down the East Coast building out at. So, if we just say, and this is, I'm sort of just brainstorming with you, if 6.5 cents is right now the lowest cost offshore wind in the United States, and land-based wind lowest cost is 2 cents per kilowatt hour, maybe it is 3-1. But I don't know that we really have any idea yet. And that 2 cents per kilowatt hour is here in the Midwest. That's not what it would cost on the East Coast. So comparing where you're going to build things and where you're going to source things, I think we have to look at whether or not offshore wind is competitive with traditional fuels in those areas.
It's hard to do apples and apples.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Looks like we should probably wrap up. I'll have the prerogative for one last question here, and that is, you've got a room full of journalists here. What's one project or policy or technology you wish would be covered? What's a story waiting to be written?
You already teamed up for that, weren't
you? So I'm going to paint a picture of Maryland's offshore wind farms. So I think most people in this room probably know offshore wind polls show, survey show, enjoys significant support, bipartisan support among the public. But not everyone likes it. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. In Ocean City, Maryland, the town of Ocean City unanimously passed a resolution opposing the two proposed wind farms off the coast of Maryland. They cited concerns about loss of tourism, various other reasons. And as a business network, we always encourage developers to work collaboratively, to take concerns seriously. So that's not what's surprising. But what we observed then is that the town of Ocean City hired the most expensive lobbyist in the state to push legislation that would require that the wind farms be pushed farther out and effectively kill the projects. Then there was a banner plane flying up and down the beach with this huge banner of this, Photoshop visual showing these huge wind turbines, and at the bottom it said, SaveOurBeachView.com. So you go to SaveOurBeachView.com, and it's a website full of all this, I believe, inaccurate or, exaggerated information about all of these negative impacts of wind farms. And then at the very bottom you see this is a project of the Caesar Rodney Institute, which is a Delaware organization. So what's a Delaware organization doing getting involved in Maryland offshore wind? And then you look at, you just do some Google searching, and then the guy who runs energy for the Caesar Rodney Institute is on the advisory board for the Heartland Institute, which is part of the Koch Network. And so, what on the surface appears like, community concerns about visual impact, et cetera, can I produce a paper trail? No. But, if there's a room of journalists in here who want to follow a trail and see if you can connect the dots, I mean, to me, just speaking personally, not on behalf of the network, there's a clear connection there that I think the public deserves to know about.
Quickly, Stephanie and Rob.
Well, mine's much less sexy than that, because that's full of intrigue and all kinds of nefarious things. I think this is, I said it earlier, this is not just an East Coast story. And so, I think it's a lot of the attention to offshore wind is written about where it's happening in terms of its procurement and where offshore wind farms are going to be built. And that makes sense. But I think we have new data. We're just going to be releasing a white paper on this, that the first 10 gigawatts of offshore wind will drive $52 billion in CapEx expenditure in this country to build 1,100 turbines, 3,000 miles of array cables and export cables, and scores of onshore and offshore substations. And those are going to be built all around this country. And so the full geographic extent of the importance of this industry to this country, I think, gets underreported. So the Wire East Coast sources talking about East Coast wind in Michigan, there's actually companies in Michigan that are going to help to build those offshore wind farms on the East Coast. And I think that's something that the industry itself hasn't been as good at communicating, but also I think is something that helps to really underscore this is an American industry and not a coastal energy story.
Great. Rob?
Wow. Most underreported story. I think I would say, I don't know if it's underreported, but it's least understood, and we're at this tipping point. So I guess it would be, we have, four times as much energy, pollution-free energy off our coast with no fuel costs. And, I'm just talking about the Atlantic coast. Why the hell haven't we tapped into it yet? I'm struggling with that how I'm going to explain that to future generations, right? It's like, and I can't take all the blame for not having done that because I've tried to convince some of the obstacles of it. But no, but you know what I mean? So, but it is kind of ridiculous when you think about all the things that we do to figure out how to get energy, drill sideways, bust up rocks, have big tankers, pressurize natural gas, do all the things we do, and then this stuff isn't feasible, you know. So it's on us, I think, to make sure that, you know, we've been spending a lot of time trying to make sure that people, of all the renewable resources, that people have a better understanding of the potential. And while it's still a tiny fraction, you know, in this case 30 megawatts, there's a lot of water building up behind the dam ready to spill over. And again, I'm using all these bad metaphors, but I think that, you know, that's something that's worth looking into and asking.
Great. Well, thank you so much to our panelists, and thanks for all your great questions.